My name is Talk Radio. My name is Elizabeth on behalf of Education Descend on Blog Talk Radio. I'm here today with Jim Ray, who's a New York City school teacher. He's writing a book called Out of Time Teacher about a situation as a teacher at John Adams High School in Ozone Park, Queens, New York. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you for having me.
Now, for those that don't know, you've blogged chapter one and chapter two of the book you're writing.
Yes, I blogged the raw and unedited versions of the first two chapters. I've already made changes to these two chapters to include some additional material.
Where can listeners find this?
They can go to any web engine, okay, or search engine and type in Jim, J-I-M, Ray, R-E-A, dot Weebly, W-E-E-B-L-Y, dot com. I'll read that again. J-I-M-R-E-A dot W-E-E-B-L-Y dot C-O-M.
JimRay.Weebly.com.
Exactly.
Perfect. Thank you. Now, I wanted to ask you about the first chapter of your book in which you talk about the fact that you were not rehired at John Adams High School. This despite the fact that you've always had the highest global region's passing rate, and you've never had an observed lesson that graded below effective.
In 11 years, I've never had an ineffective rating for any observed lesson. My global region's passing rates were either the highest or second highest for every year that I taught global, with the possible exception of my first year. I would love it if the school would challenge that claim, because they would invariably find out that my numbers were actually better than they thought they were over time. Now, I really don't want to talk about my accomplishments.
Understood.
There were several years in which I actually doubled the school passing rate. They track individual numbers much closer for the last 4 years since we got a new principal. I talked in the last interview about how much he is concerned with data.
And you weren't rehired. And you also have a website that's catered to help students pass the global regions.
Yes, and the United States regions as well. And I know that is effective because the people that matter most, the students, have always told me so.
Has the school ever promoted that website?
Not really. The word of it generally spread among the students themselves, not to mention the study guide that I developed that could have been distributed among the students via their teachers. But this all illustrates that it was always community-oriented, my efforts. And I would add that I can't imagine any of my colleagues saying that I was ever anything but forthcoming in sharing anything that I thought would be of value to them. Teachers that want to hoard the materials that they've developed don't endeavor to put them up on the internet.
Nor do they get to school at 4:40 a.m., I would imagine. Now, come on, is that really true?
I have many years of time cards that verify this. I actually got there earlier just in case the person that let me in got in early. I'm telling you, it was many hours of standing outside in the freezing cold.
And according to Chapter 1, in order to get into the building to do voluntary work.
Work that I wasn't compensated for. I have no regrets about that because I was helping a friend.
But it still speaks of a certain attitude on your part.
I think so. And while most of my colleagues didn't know I was doing it, my students knew because I told them over time. I always felt it was important to convey an image of a hard worker, and I would tell them that I enjoyed my life when it was time to do so, but I was willing to be dedicated above and beyond when the time called. And I never complained to them about that because I wanted them to realize that I felt that what I was doing as a teacher at John Adams was extremely important. And they knew that I was willing to do whatever was necessary to help them succeed.
And yet you weren't hired back.
No. And that sent a very confusing message to them. A great lesson conveyed to them by virtue of example was abolished by virtue of political interference and dysfunction.
You're referring to the interviews themselves?
The interview process was a farce, and everyone knew it. In the days following May 23rd, when I received word that I wasn't hired back, I must have spoken to at least 70 John Adams people that were familiar with the interview process. It was conveyed to me that they were absolutely shocked by the failure to rehire me. And while I appreciate that fact, the questions that they would ask me were even more telling.
What did they ask you?
They would ask how well I got along with the principal, Daniel Scanlon, or the one assistant principal, Scott Silverman, that was on the selection committee. Not once did anyone ever ask me how I answered a specific interview question. And while it was conveyed to all teachers that the interview process was going to be the driving force, many didn't reapply because they felt that they wouldn't be rehired for other factors.
Such as?
Well, just what I said. Personal feelings that weren't supposed to enter into an objective process. It was commonly felt that scores were going to be settled, which I personally feel is a betrayal of public trust.
How so?
Well, think of any other official process where people can't be objective. Aren't the ones that can't be objective expected to recuse themselves? Instead, at John Adams, people actually theorized that interviewees were not hired back because of personal vendettas, or they did their unforgivable, they opened their mouth. Something that I'd like to address later. It was glaringly obvious that certain people would go into the interview and they could throw up on the interview table and get hired back. And others certainly could answer the questions well enough to be hired back, but had no chance of that happening.
Not even the guy that got there at 4:30 in the morning.
And kept his mouth shut and did everything that he was supposed to do outside the classroom as well.
So why were you not hired back?
The rehiring committee was made up of the principal, the assistant principal I told you about, a woman from the district, and three members from the United Federation of Teachers, our union. Word got back to me from informed sources that the two members from inside our school, whom I always got along with, most certainly wanted me back. And if they didn't, what possibly could be a valid reason? That mostly leaves the very people that should have been there expressly for the reasons of ensuring that it was a fair and equitable process, and that's the union. The people that I pay to protect me from the very thing that has happened to me. They are actually supposed to protect the teachers that have questionable dedication and ability. To sell out on the ones that have demonstrated a desire to go above and beyond and have an exemplary record otherwise is just reprehensible. And if they try to say that it was an interview, the interview itself, well, no one familiar with the process believes that.
Why not?
Well, one of the questions was, can you describe any professional development that had an impact on you? Now, what they are referring to are the training sessions that teachers have to go through as a means of retraining or development.
Okay, I think most people know what professional development is when it comes to the teaching profession.
And most of them think we need more of it. But can we get back to that a little later?
Sure, we can.
All right, so now, isn't that question itself an extremely subjective question? If you go to an art museum and I ask you which work of art impacted you the most, is there a wrong answer? Does it not involve your outlook and level of sophistication?
Of course.
So how could I have answered wrong when I said that the professional developments that I felt were most valuable were the ones where teachers work closely with other teachers, something commonly known as collaboration. The times when we were able to share strategies, methodologies, materials, ideas, information relating to students, parental contacts. Anyone inside the profession knows, except I guess administrators and politicians, that teachers make other teachers better. And the word I used in my interview was magic. Not only extremely helpful, it builds morale and camaraderie. It's lightning in a bottle and it's right in front of the administration's nose and they refuse to see it. What they usually come up with is not only weak and unappealing, it can also be expensive to the public.
How could it be expensive to the public?
Well, they pay for everything through taxes. Right now, as we speak, all of the John Adams teachers are at school a week early for professional development. Now, this serves no purpose other than to satisfy a need for political posturing. They're going over what is known as witsy writing strategies.
Strategies to help the students write better?
Yes, which we covered throughout last year, both in full-day professional developments and for two periods each week throughout the year. So why are the veteran teachers there and getting paid if they already knew these strategies? Why not just bring in the new teachers? Again, political posture. In fact, the only thing that will result in addition to another blow to morale is that the data usage of the teachers' electronic devices will spike up. And the public shouldn't blame them. It's punitive in both nature and practice and nothing else.
Why would you say punitive other than the fact that they lose a week of their summer vacation?
When we were encouraged to quote unquote reapply for a job last year, we were told that it would involve coming back a week early. What was already a demeaning process became even more demeaning. Now, the administration wanted a certain number of teachers to reapply and certain teachers to reapply, but they also wanted a healthy number not to. In fact, our union was aware of something that they didn't share with its members, an omission that tells you where they were throughout this process.
What was that?
That if the number of teachers at John Adams or any other of the six renewal schools that made its teachers reapply for the job and be discriminated against.
Discriminated against?
Absolutely. I see it as discrimination. I teach at John Adams, therefore I must be treated differently than most other New York City school teachers. Were we not being profiled based on something that was largely out of our control? And where was the union? Not just aiding and abetting the process, but actually participating in it.
So what was it that they knew that they didn't share with their members?
That if less than 50% of the teachers failed to reapply, that the whole rehiring process would have been eliminated for that particular school. They had the ability to spare their members with regard to this totally demeaning process, but instead withheld this information. A total sellout.
And what was your motivation?
Well, I'm hoping the truth will eventually wash up ashore, but it won't happen unless someone makes waves.
Didn't you have a local union chapter leader?
Yes, and I think I speak for most of the teachers at John Adams when I say that she did a great job, especially in lieu of the fact that she had only been elected and it was her first year. All this went on at levels way above her.
So where does this leave schools like John Adams?
Leaves them with a largely inexperienced staff. Many teachers that were willing to help the new teachers are gone. Morale among even the rehired teachers is deplorably low. Key individuals not rehired and will not be easily replaced. Really hard to see anything positive that came out of this. And taxpayer money was used to make what was judged to be a quote-unquote bad school into a much worse one. All the progress that was made will most certainly be wiped out. And I think that there should be an independent evaluation as a means of judging that. And when it is invariably found out that this was a wrong course of action, that it should be decided that it will never happen again. And they should never appeal to a process as foolhardy and discriminatory as what they did at John Adams and other renewal schools. Someone has to be held accountable for this. The media and the taxpaying public have to be all over this and start placing the blame where it belongs. And I said in the first interview, it's not the teachers, for the most part.
For the most part. What part are they responsible for?
Well, teaching is like any other profession. Some are better than others. We all went to school and we all remember that. But there is a misnomer among the general public that tenured teachers have jobs for life, even if they are ineffective. And that's simply not true, or at least it's never been true at John Adams.
So they can get rid of bad teachers?
And they do, along with some good ones, unfortunately. Every year there are teachers that they're able to remove, but they take that to an even more damaging level. And I say this as someone that doesn't object to their removing the truly bad teachers. I think any of the truly dedicated teachers feel that if you're just mailing it in, that you've paved your way out the door. And I also say that this is someone that has never been targeted by the administration. And as I told you, I don't think that the administration targeted me during the rehiring process, but they certainly didn't protect me either, which I still can't fathom. But the whole observation and evaluation process has a sinister underside to it.
Does this involve getting rid of good teachers?
Yes. And for reasons that don't address their actual effectiveness. Remember before when I talked about teachers that opened their mouths?
Yeah.
Now, this is usually looked upon as these teachers being troublemakers, but that's so often not the case. Now, I rarely spoke up because I learned that it just was a waste of time. The administration treats teachers as if they have nothing worthwhile to say, and that they should just follow directions and administration-approved methodologies, and robotically carry on the educational mission if they are ordered to do so. I think that the taxpaying public would be shocked if they were to truly learn just how stifled teachers are. We're the ones that are on the front lines, the ones that have the best vantage points to say what is working and what is not working in the classroom and among the students, and yet most of the teachers stifled by fear that they will not provide real feedback to the administration. So in other words, they're afraid to say, this isn't working. Some tried, and they all have something in common. They weren't hired back. Teach them a lesson as far as the administration is concerned. And how is that communicated to the rest of the rehiring committee? But teachers that, quote, unquote, open their mouths are not the malcontents or the chronic complainants. They're often the ones that make things better and are willing to stick their necks out in order for that to happen. But at John Adams, you don't hear their say-so. You'll pay a price.
How so?
Now, again, it never happened to me, but it was well known that classroom observations are not entirely objective. There is a rubric, but it can be affected by subjectivity just like the interview process was. Two teachers can give the same exact lesson, but that doesn't ensure the same exact result. And if you are someone that is being targeted, and they never seem to get to the point where they run out of these targeted teachers, you don't have a chance. If they want to make you, if they want to make a case, they can make a case. And it might be just because you open your mouth so that things could be better. It gets so bad at times, I think that administrators should read a pledge of objectivity during a pre-observation that will remind them that they ought to be totally objective and that all other considerations will not enter into the process.
Are there any administrators that are not guilty of this?
Absolutely. But it seems that even they get occasional marching orders to go after certain teachers. And it can be for something completely innocuous. I might also add that most administrators are afraid to speak up as well. And it goes right down the ladder. Bad decisions get handed down or acted upon even if they are known to be negative, and they keep going down until they affect the students themselves. How you treat a teacher is a straight line to how the teacher feels about their job and how they will perform it accordingly.
What would you do if you were an administrator?
You know, we have something at John Adams, or I'm not there anymore, had something at school called at John Adams called PBIS. It's not overly popular among the teachers because it only really impacts those students that are willing to participate in it. And the real problems get covered up. And because John Adams tries to showcase their involvement, some real problems have been systematically covered up. I believe there was an article in the New York Post about it. But the whole philosophy behind PBIS, with the PB standing for positive behavior, doesn't apply to the teachers. We were supposed to reinforce positive behavior, but the administration creates a hostile environment. These two things don't coincide. If you want the teachers to reward positive behavior, then you have to reinforce positive aspects in all areas. And that means creating a positive environment among the teachers. The administration and political higher-ups not only fail to do that, they go overboard with it. Teachers in good schools don't have to attend as many meetings and undergo useless training like they do at John Adams. They're treated like professionals and are able to utilize their free time to plan lessons, work with other teachers, contact parents to improve attendance, and address other issues. It's one of the things that makes a good school, or makes them a good school. At John Adams, we were all treated as if we would waste our free time if they ever allowed us to have it. Well, I, for one, can point to a ton of recent study material that's the byproduct of using my free time productively. The end result was a heck of a lot better than anything that they had me do in what, ironically, is called common planning time. So I guess what I'm saying is that if you treat teachers with the respect they deserve, and reinforce the professionalism that most all of them have, the results will speak for themselves.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
One of the things, like coming from the business world, like I have, is the lack of praise that passes from administrators to teachers. As a former manager, I would have loved to have managed in the teaching environment, if it was left to my own devices, of course.
How so?
Well, because praise is free. In the business world, if you tell someone that they're doing a great job, they're going to automatically be looking to hit you up for a raise. In the teaching profession, praise doesn't come with a cost. It only leads to a profit. I would be utilizing positive reinforcement at every turn. It should be so easy to create a positive environment among the teachers because they all are willing to do everything they need to collaborate with each other to sustain a positive environment. What they do at John Adams, they not only create a hostile or negative environment, they create a punitive environment as well. And the proof of that is that they are right now sitting through professional development that will do nothing to advance the cause of education.
Does all this negativity happen at all schools, to your knowledge?
I don't believe it happens at all schools. In fact, again, I think it doesn't happen at all at what they consider the good schools. And that is the big part of the reason why they are known as good schools. It's the trickle-down effect. Once a school is designated as a bad school, the politicians get involved, and the resultant oversight is counterproductive, and what remains is a self-fulfilling prophecy. Every action they take is another shot in the foot. No, teachers at most of the schools can't relate to what goes on at John Adams. certainly not in its entirety.
And how's the book going?
Well, right now I'm working on chapter 3, but I won't be blogging any of the remaining chapters. I hope to be able to continue to write it during the school year, but we'll see if I'm able to do that. I've already started a journal about the upcoming school year.
So you haven't revealed everything yet?
Not even close. In fact, I always said if I ever did indeed write a book like this, that it would be called The Public Has a Right to Know. They pay the taxes, and they were woefully misinformed. Trust me on that one.
Well, it sounds like there's something to look forward to, and I want to thank you for taking the time and coming all the way out here to New Jersey to do this interview, Jim.
Oh, no, thank you. It certainly was something I needed to do. And good luck to all my fellow teachers during the upcoming school year.
That concludes this interview.
Thank you.